If it were possible to make an apolitical journey.
That's interesting.
I think that would be the ideal.
Yeah.
To really take all the rhetoric and all the ideology out of the equation and just play music, people playing music for other people.
My name is Michael Pavlitz.
I'm Alan Gilbert.
This is About Music
and Life.
Today we have another episode of our podcast talking about
travel, all the things that go along with being a musician, involving being on the road, the question of whether orchestras can and should travel,
and the chaos which can happen.
Quite a lot of interesting things came up in our conversation, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Alan, it's so nice of you to welcome us here at your place.
Well, it was very convenient because we always have these cameras here, so we thought we might as well just use them, you know, have a little show in our living room.
Yeah, it's a family place. It's a place where you live. It's a place where you prepare, I guess.
This is our living room, and you can't see it on camera, but kind of a music room. We have our piano in there, but absolutely in use every day.
So for you, it must be special to be at home. Usually, I think you're traveling.
Well, this is very nice of you to make the trip here because obviously you came all the way from Hamburg to Stockholm, where I live and work. I'm a music director of the Royal Swedish Opera, and I'm also happen to be conducting the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic this week and next. I travel a lot. Obviously, Hamburg is one of my important cities. I spend a lot of time there. But this is very unusual, kind of unprecedented. I'm, I think, a 2.5 month stretch in Stockholm straight.
Wow.
I don't think that's happened.
How does it feel? Is it?
It's mostly it's delightful. It's so nice not to. I haven't been on a plane in over 2 months now, and I miss Hamburg. I miss my friends and colleagues in Hamburg, and it's strange not to be there for such a long time. But I have to say, it's just so luxurious not to have to travel.
I would love to travel more because I'm stuck in the studio. And I do these interviews with our correspondents who are all over the world. But I'm at this one place and I have this one way home. And
that sounds like a dream to me.
To you? I would like to do that. I would like to live your life for 2 months.
I can't complain. It's wonderful to travel. And I love being in different cities and experiencing different cultures and foods, and I have friends all over the world now.
Yeah.
Orchestras, I think, benefit from touring.
Yeah.
I think there's an excitement.
This is what I want to ask. Why do musicians travel that much? To build your name or to get known better? Or?
Well, I mean, it is fun. I mean, it's exciting. It's nice to be asked, and if people ask you to come conduct them, it's, you know, you can understand why people want to do it and enjoy the opportunities. It's a lot of fun. It's very exciting to take an orchestra on the road. It's a huge logistical undertaking. Yeah. Musicians have to be moved, instruments, music, hotels, buses, trains, visas, passports. I mean, there's so many things that have to be thought of. It's very complicated and it's hugely expensive.
Yeah.
I actually think that there's an artistic gain that comes from taking an orchestra on tour, because the challenge of playing in different halls, we can talk about that, what it means to adjust to different halls. That's an interesting subject in and of itself. But playing for different audiences, feeling the pressure of showing yourself at your best, you know, being compared implicitly to the orchestras that either resident in the cities you're visiting or other orchestras that pass through. If you're going to Carnegie Hall, you know that, you know, all the great orchestras in the world pass through, and so you're being held to
extra tension.
And orchestras, I think, grow from being on tour.
Okay.
You tend to play the same program over and over again, and if you work on a piece and get it better and better and better, that's a kind of work that doesn't happen in the normal week-to-week schedule that you do at home. So I think there's an artistic advantage or a benefit that comes from touring. And it's also nice, I think, to share the fact that there's this wonderful cultural entity, and if we share it, it's a kind of ambassadorship. That it's a way of bringing people together, and there are a lot of, I think, strong points of showing shared humanity and building artistic bridges with people in faraway countries and cities.
I just looked at the history of the NDR Philharmonic Orchestra, and it was amazing. I think they were the first orchestra going to Russia after the war, and doing a tour to France as an ambassador, and it's moving to see, to try to new start after the Second World War, after the Nazis, with this ambassador, with this orchestra.
Yeah, show a positive side and show goodwill and the desire to share something, make a positive statement. I think that's very strong. There is pushback, especially these days. People say, why should orchestras tour? You know, if you go to Tokyo, there are 8 or 9 professional orchestras. Why do you need to hear another one?
Would you go to China now?
Right now?
With the orchestra?
I think it's a more complicated question than that. I think it deserves more than a simple answer. Because I don't know. I would love to be able to go to China and make the
there
right
connections. There was this academy, I think, in Shanghai.
I mean, there's strong connections. Yeah. If it were possible to make an apolitical journey.
That's interesting.
That would be, I think that would be the ideal.
Yeah.
To really take all the rhetoric and all the posturing and all the ideology out of the equation and just play music, people playing music for other people.
But is there a chance?
Is that possible?
Yeah, it's always political.
It's difficult now. There was a famous trip that the New York Philharmonic made when my mother was still playing, before I was there. It was Lauren Mazel conducting, and they traveled to Pyongyang, and they played in North Korea.
Yeah.
And there was a concert that I think CNN broadcast live worldwide from Pyongyang, the New York Philharmonic playing. And it was a very unusual concert. I was traveling myself, and I happened to be in the airport lounge and watched part of the concert. And I was very moved because I saw my mom, I saw my friends, I saw the orchestra, and it was a very unusual atmosphere, because you could see that the audience was very, very formal, very, very polite, very still, kind of impassive, didn't seem to show a lot of expression on their faces. And I'm not sure how familiar they were with music. I'm not even sure if they knew what they were going to hear, or if they were made to go, or if it was...
Do you remember the program?
Well, they played An American in Paris. Mm-hmm. I think they played some Bernstein, New World Symphony. I don't remember everything, but
American music.
Yeah, okay. It was very exciting. But my mom and everyone who was there, they said, what was fascinating is by the end of the concert, they played Arirang, which is a Korean, one of the most important folk songs. The audience started to cry, and somehow the barrier that had been there broke down, and everybody was moved finally, and it became a real connection. I don't know, given the current political climate, if such a trip would be allowed, because
talking about China,
I'm talking about China, or I'm talking about North Korea, anywhere, because people are very quick to say, well, if you go there, then you're implicitly accepting or endorsing their political system. Obviously, no one was accepting or endorsing the North Korean political system when they went there, and the idea was actually the opposite. The hope was that there would be some kind of thaw, that it would help diplomatic relations. Mm-hmm. Hasn't exactly panned out that way. I mean, I personally think it was a worthwhile and important gesture. I'm not sure that cutting off engagement is the ultimate answer. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit what people are saying. Well, you know, that's what's happened now with Russia after Russia invaded Ukraine. There's been a very, very clear statement by very wide.
And there were tight bonds, especially European.
It wasn't even a question. And I guess the real question is, where do you draw the line? Because there's no political system that is flawless.
Who makes the decision, for example, at your orchestra? Is it the orchestra? Is it you? Is it the management? Or
I think it becomes a collective kind of consensus. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I guess it's, you know, the top management that makes the call. But obviously, when there are things that are sensitive and are existing in the gray area, I mean, we're talking in abstraction, so it's very difficult to actually, you know, be clear or know exactly what the right answers are, because it's not even clear what the question is. But it's not exactly the same question. But there have been music competitions that have banned Russian musicians, young Russian musicians, from going, simply because they're Russian. And I think it's possible that there may be some justification for that, but for it to be a kind of blanket, black and white protocol, I think that's a mistake, actually, because the young musicians, they're the ones that we don't want to exclude. We hope to continue to have relations and connections and openness across borders. You know, musicians should be able to play music together wherever they're from, and there's no country that, I mean, if you start saying there's a litmus test that has to be passed in order for a musician to be allowed to work with you, who would pass?
Yeah,
really
difficult.
It's very difficult.
You will go to Japan, I think, in November.
We're going with the orchestra.
Yeah,
so, yeah, I'm very excited.
So what is it for you? Does it mean to go to Japan with this orchestra?
Well, I love going to Japan. You know, anytime. My mother is Japanese. I feel very close to the country. I spend a lot of time there. I have a position with a Japanese orchestra, the Tokyo Metropolitan Symphony Orchestra. I'm principal guest conductor there, and it's especially gratifying to bring my own orchestra to share what we do in Japan.
You know, difference between the audiences?
Audiences are absolutely different everywhere. In a way, they're all the same.
Yeah.
But they're also different. There's a different vibe. And people always comment on Japanese audiences because they're so incredibly quiet. Mm-hmm. It's almost uncanny. It's strange, I think, if you're not expecting.
No coughing. We talked about coughing before.
No coughing, but there's a kind of stillness to the quiet. I mean, even if you hear a quiet hall in the States or in Europe, there's a kind of, you can feel a little bit of vibration. When the conductor walks in, they clap, turns around. It's almost terrifying, and it's weird. You think, how did that happen with such a large room with that quiet? And I think people who are experiencing it for the first time might mistake it for a kind of detachment. Mm-hmm. Actually, Japanese audiences are passionate and very knowledgeable and have very discerning tastes. But something in the culture is very, very careful in that kind of public setting. So it feels different.
What about the programs? Do you have more success with special programs in Japan?
That's kind of a pet peeve of mine in Japan. The programming is very conservative, in my opinion. And they're very specific ideas that Japanese presenters have about what orchestras should play, both visiting orchestras who come on tour to Japan, but also the Japanese orchestras. I mean, it's like a running joke I have when I'm planning programs, that because you hear the New World Symphony, Tchaikovsky Fifth Symphony, Beethoven 7, over and pictures at an exhibition, over and over and over again.
Why?
All great pieces.
Why?
I don't know. It's like this, I don't know, brand name, you know. If it has a famous name, it must be good. I don't know. There's, it's kind of reflexively timid the way they make choices. And I think it's unnecessary, because when you play different things and when you show kind of daring in your programming, it's always appreciated. It always works, but somehow the first impulse is to be very careful. And so that, you know, it happens that we're playing a lot of German music when we go to Japan. And
do you know what you're going to play this
playing
year?
Playing Brahms symphonies. And part of that is that we're not bringing such the full orchestra with, you know, big percussion and lots of brass. So that works very well. And it's also something that I think we, you know, we play exceptionally well with a special kind of understanding and insight. So it's very nice to do that. But It's hard. I find it hard to program in Japan often, because there's such expectations about what you should play. And part of what I want to do when I bring, certainly when I bring things, is to shake things up and show that it doesn't have to be.
Contemporary music you bring too, or?
Absolutely. Yeah.
No, I think this works with total fresh stuff. And
sure. Absolutely. But I'm not sure that they think that it will work. So it's a little bit, it's the same phenomenon that happens everywhere, but it's particularly pronounced in Japan, I would say.
Does it reflect the idea or relationship to Western culture in a way?
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting question.
And we could talk Japanese folk songs.
We're talking about travel, you know. Now we're really focusing on Japan.
When you come with an orchestra, and I think my father brought once a record from Japan. He was a scientist, and he brought me folk songs from Japan. And I didn't understand the music at all. I liked it. I liked to listen to it.
Yeah.
No, and then I see the joy Japanese people have listening to Beethoven. And I can't make the connections.
No, it's a very interesting question, because it's not unrelated to certain topics of cultural imperialism and identity. And I have mixed feelings about it, because it's a shame that the sort of the long traditions and the local culture is not so present. I mean, if you go to Tokyo, it feels like a, you know, extremely modern, advanced Western city. And we say Western, and that's already, you know, a loaded term, but hopefully I can get away with saying it, because I just mean it's, you know, it could be like London. I mean, it's a little bit different. It could be Shanghai, it could be New York. And but then there are Japanese buildings and there are Japanese architectural details, and you'll see something that could only be in Japan, and this mixture of sort of local and imported creates a very unusual and delicate balance. It's one of the narratives when Japan is spoken about that you hear over and over again, that Japan is very good at taking on imported things and improving them and doing them their way, like, you know,
like the trains,
you know, whatever, and that is really true, and I think people mostly would think, oh, yeah, that's a good point. That's a nice thing about Japan. But there's the side of that discussion that becomes a little dark and not so comfortable for me when the assumption is, well, everything is just sort of taken on and it's not really deeply felt or understood. Mm-hmm. It's like an imitation.
Yeah.
And there is a kind of sense often, and you hear this in Europe and in the States, oh, well, they're good, but they don't really understand it. Yeah. They're just very good at imitating. And I think that's racist and not fair. Because people approach music a little bit differently based on their backgrounds by definition.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that just because someone is Asian, they can't play, say, Mozart with true understanding, I think is, well, it's just wrong, and it's not true.
We have many examples which prove the opposite,
I think.
Yeah.
And the idea, I've maybe even mentioned it before, the idea that music can withstand interpretation and doesn't have to be done the way that, call it, the people who wrote it, or because even people in, say, all right, I'll take Mozart, even people in Austria today are not really coming from the exact same place that Mozart did.
Yeah.
They're also changed. The whole culture has changed.
And so, Brahms composed his stuff in Austria, most of it.
Also, Anyway, this is, how do we always get on these?
I don't know. I think it's about to bring culture, this idea of an orchestra traveling.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting time because, you know, some people say, well, why do we need to hear that music? You know, what's important about that? I mean, it's a highly developed, wonderful art form, and it doesn't mean it's the only thing. For me, it happens to be what I do, so it is what I can offer. I can't offer something else.
So you will travel the coming years a lot, like now, or do you think you're to reduce it? Or
I've consciously been trying to reduce the amount of travel I do. I mean, you know what it's like. Your trip now, canceled flight, strikes.
For me, it's an adventure. It's just
It's adventures are great until they become just boring hardships. Yeah. I love to travel, and I do get a little bit impatient sometimes when I'm in one place for too long, although I'm not feeling that at all now. I still have several weeks left of my 2.5 month stay in Stockholm, but I've consciously tried to reduce the amount of travel I do, just because of the wear and tear on the system, but also with the idea that maybe it's better not to fly so much, try to keep the carbon footprint from going to bananas.
That's why
I took the John Hopper position here.
So
I'm Hamburg and the opera, those are my two places, and I'm doing considerably less guest conducting.
But environment is a subject, so you think it's, about...
Well, orchestras are talking about it all the time, and I think they should be. There's some orchestras that have decided not to fly, and there's some musicians, some colleagues I have said they're not going to fly. That's a personal choice.
We thought about coming by train.
I would love to take the train. Unfortunately, the train connection between Stockholm and Hamburg is not really practical yet.
They have this night thing.
Night train, I've taken it. I would do it every time if I could, but the last time I did, the train was so hot.
Okay.
It was unbearably hot. It was unpleasant. I couldn't sleep because, even just in a t-shirt, you were just like dripping in sweat, and there was nothing to do. There was something wrong with the system. So it's just not, if it were comfortable, I could sleep and then go straight into the rehearsal.
Yeah,
but
if you go
all night and you're suffering and then have to work immediately, it's unfortunately not practical. The bottom line is that everything we do creates some sort of impact on the environment, and you just have to decide where your personal tolerance is, where you're going to draw the line and say, okay, this I'm not going to do because it's too much impact on the environment. And for me and for a lot of people, we are continuing to travel, but mindfully, and maybe not as much as we used to. But what do you think? Do you think orchestras should keep touring?
Difficult question. I would say yes. Yeah, maybe not necessarily too much, but maybe not constantly on the road, but maybe every 2 years, tour to Europe, not every year or other way around. But I would say yes, yeah. I feel a bit bad because of the carbon footprint, but saying this.
There's no perfect answer. Yeah, I think you're just like all of us. We
don't feel
somehow know that it's not ideal, but I still think that the benefit outweighs the negative side because it's so important to. I think it's good not to essentially create even harder borders between people and countries.
Okay.
Well, I'll see you here, there, or in some city around the world.
Thank you, thank you for that we could visit you, and you gave me the chance to travel.
You're welcome, anytime. I don't think we've answered any questions, but we've asked a lot of questions.
Yeah, so but it's difficult to answer questions.
Yeah.